You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
To the rich man's bright lodges I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding in the damp foggy midnight.
A lot of things we need in this country right now. We need jobs. We need something to stimulate our economy. We need certainty in the credit market. But probably more than anything, what we need in this country right now is confidence. Confidence that we can face down these problems and move forward like America has always done. And what do we have instead of confidence? Raw anger. I'm mad. Everyone I work for is mad. You know, anger can be constructive if we channel it. And I'm here today to say it's time that we channel this anger and change the law. We don't need anger. We have a bunch of idiots on Wall Street that are kicking sand in the face of the American taxpayer. My colleague just talked about some of them, but let me, review. These financial institutions, on the brink of extinction, come to the American taxpayer for hundreds and billions of dollars. At the very same time, they think they're going to buy a $50 million corporate jet. They're going to pay out $18 billion in bonuses. They paid an average of $2.6 million to every executive at the first 116 banks that got taxpayer money under TARP. Let me say that again. An average of $2.6 million in executive pay to the folks at the first 116 banks that got money from the taxpayers. They don't get it. These people are idiots. You can't use taxpayer money to pay out $18 billion in bonuses. Merrill Lynch is unbelievable. They saved $3 to $4 billion from the pot of money that was going to Bank of America. The sale is going to close the first week in January. They always gave bonuses in January. You know what these sneaky guys did? They decided to give their bonuses in December, before the Bank of America took over. Paid out $3 to $4 billion in bonuses in December, and that quarter, Merrill Lynch lost $21 billion. What planet are these people on? What could they be thinking about? So here's what this bill's going to do. This is called the Chief Executive Pay Act, Officer Pay Act of 2009, and it's very simple. Going forward, you want taxpayers to help you survive? You want the people at your financial institution to have a job tomorrow? Then you're going to have to limit everyone's pay at your company to the same salary that the President of the United States makes. Is that so unreasonable? It's 8 times the median household income in the United States of America, $400,000 a year. I don't think that sounds like a bad deal. Should these people be making more than the President of the United States? Now, really, should they? They should not be making more of the President of the United States. So every executive going forward cannot make more than $400,000 a year. And they have to limit that executive compensation for everyone in their company until they pay back every dime to the taxpayers. Now, once they're off the public dole, once the taxpayers aren't footing the bill, then it's not as much our business what they get paid. But right now, they're on the hook to us. And they owe us something other than a fancy wastebasket and a $50 million jet. They owe us some common sense. And if any of them think it's a hardship to take the salary of the President of the United States, I dare them to say so out loud right now. Because that's not going to instill confidence, Mr. President. What's going to instill confidence? For the men and women in these companies to realize it's time for everyone in this country to tighten their belt. It's time for everyone to realize that we must have our financial institutions survive, but not with a culture that thinks it's okay to kick the taxpayer in the shins while they drink champagne and fly in fancy jets. It doesn't work, not in the United States of America. I asked my colleagues to sign on this bill. I think it makes sense. We should have done it in the first place, but I don't think any of us thought these guys were this stupid. I don't think any of us believed that they would take billions of dollars of bonuses while their institutions were literally days from being wiped out. But they did. And we've learned our lesson. And so I hope all my colleagues will sign on this bill. I hope we can get it passed quickly so that from this day forward, the President of the United States will make the same amount of money as the executives at these companies that owe the taxpayers hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. Thank you, Mr. President, and I yield the floor.
That was Senator Claire McCaskill speaking on the Senate floor Friday. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. McCaskill described the Wall Street and corporate executives as idiots. I think it's not idiocy. It's the arrogance of aristocracy. In this case, an economic aristocracy. I think McCaskill knows this too. She just wasn't willing to describe it in those terms. I think she knows this because of her repeated references to kicking the taxpayers, a modern version of the nobleman mowing down pedestrians as his carriage speeds through the crowded and narrow streets of the city, while Washington is engaged in Herculean efforts to save the system. The show this week will continue with the discussion of the need for systemic change, not a preservation of business as usual. This system can neither be ecologically sustainable, because it's premised on an ever-increasing consumption of the ecosystem, nor can it be morally justifiable, because it is not geared toward life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for everyone, but happiness for some at the expense of others. We keep being told that the banks must be saved because they are at the heart of our system. They are the custodians of that monster of our own creation, money. The programs I aired in the past on the gift economy addresses what is a basic flaw, the very concept of the exchange economy. It's not a question of whether we barter bags of potatoes or use currency. It's the idea of assigning comparative value to the means of life and therefore to people, and withholding it from people of low monetary value. The story of the death of Marvin Schur illustrates this point. Neighbors discovered the body of the 93-year-old man in his home in Bay City, Michigan on January 17th. He slowly and painfully froze to death, according to Dr. Kanuvarani, who performed the autopsy. Hypothermia shuts the whole system down slowly, Varani said. It's not easy to die from hypothermia without first realizing your fingers and toes feel like they're burning. The city utility had installed a limiter device to restrict the use of electricity at Shore's home on January 13th, said Bay City Manager Robert Bellman. The device limits power reaching a home and blows out like a fuse if consumption rises past a set level. Power is not restored until the device is reset. Outside temperatures at the time were as low as minus 9 degrees Fahrenheit. Phil Newton, director of the electric department, said the company has almost 2 full-time people just dedicated to going around and turning people on and off and putting on limiters. It's just really bad, close quote. The city keeps the limiter on houses for 10 days, then shuts off power entirely if the homeowner hasn't paid utility bills or arranged to do so. Bay City Manager Bellman said he didn't believe the city did anything wrong. Neighbors need to keep an eye on neighbors, he said. 9 days after Shore's death, the Bay City Commission voted 5-3 to raise the prices of electricity by 3%. Marvin Shore's body was discovered by neighbor George Powells, who said Shore had almost $1,100 in unpaid electric bills. Powells told the newspaper he saw cash clipped to those bills on the kitchen table on the day he found him. His furnace was not running. The insides of his windows were full of ice the morning we found him, Powells told the Bay City News. Marvin Shore did not freeze to death because there was a scarcity of electricity to run his furnace. He died because he had neither the money to pay for it nor someone to look after him. His wife had died and he had no children. This would not have happened in a so-called primitive society. Marvin would have been part of an extended family group whose younger members would have been responsible for his care, just as Marvin in his prime would have been responsible for helping to feed, protect, and educate the next generation, even if they were not his actual children. Such basic social solidarity was practiced, according to anthropologists, even by Neanderthals. Modern capitalist society, therefore, has devolved to a level of subhuman barbarism. And there's no excuse for it. Modern society has so much surplus that no one need lack food and shelter, much less freeze to death in their home. Since the Industrial Revolution, capitalists have deliberately destroyed independent livelihoods and the safety net of kinship by uprooting people from places and turning them into nomads who follow the wage, without a land base or a society of extended family, isolating them as individuals, easier to break, control, and exploit. I've noticed that respect and care for other people goes hand in hand with respect and care for the ecosystem. Competition is just another word for contempt, for war. The death of Marvin Shore also illustrates a point author Susan Rosenthal made in last week's reading from Power and Powerlessness, that public property is not the same as the commons, which is not property, which is not owned. The Bay City Power Company, we heard, employed 2 people full-time to make sure that people who had not paid were cut off. This municipal power department, which in the wake of a death raised the rates even higher, was operating in the capitalist paradigm even though it was a so-called public entity. Making comparison again to a so-called primitive society based on the commons, nobody would have been prevented from going into the forest to collect wood. And those too young or too old to do so would still have a place to sit by the fire. The Bay City Power Company's failure to provide electricity is not about scarcity, but about ideology. Money has an unnatural attribute that forms the basis for capitalism: its ability to be endlessly accumulated. Biological systems, like our bodies, operate on the principle of the right amount, not too much nor too little. Capitalism is justified by an ideology that views the human as a creature of infinite greed who never says enough. It glorifies a pathology and enshrines the psychologically deformed as role models. Marvin Schur did not have some infinite desire for home heating. To keep his pipes from bursting, he needed his house to be above freezing. For a modicum of comfort, he needed his house to be around 65 degrees. To sit around all winter in shorts, he would have heated his house to 80 degrees. That's it, a practical limit. He would not heat his house to 120 degrees, 300 degrees. You get the idea. While the pathology of accumulation of objects at some point becomes apparent, the accumulation of vast sums of money is exempted from this common sense assessment. This is ironic because money is not a physical need, nor does it exist or have value except by collective agreement. The house being foreclosed on is considered to be worth $150,000, when a couple of years ago it was considered to be worth $400,000. Nothing about its ability to provide shelter has changed. Whether its monetary value is considered to be $10 or $1 million, its only real value is its function to provide shelter. So because money has been made an intermediary between people and their needs, we have the specter of millions becoming homeless while houses stand empty. What I truly can't understand is why people generally seem to accept such an insane social system as normal. Capitalist theorists speak of the tragedy of the commons, claiming that a thing which is not private property is not maintained because there is no owner. So-called primitive societies were able to deal with the commons in a sustainable manner, living in the same place for thousands of years without causing destruction. Those who wrote about the tragedy of the commons based their observations on the condition of common spaces within a society enclosed by the nobility. If commons were overgrazed, it was because the hereditary and financial nobility had commandeered too much and left the rest of the people an amount of common land inadequate to their needs and numbers. Then this alleged tragedy of the commons was used as a justification for the seizure and privatization of what common land remained. It is possible to determine what is enough, devise a strategy to provide it, including far more leisure than most people presently enjoy. We heard last week how the rising productivity of the American worker has not brought her either more money or more leisure. Just the opposite, because the excess productivity has been monetized and vacuumed into the bank accounts of a few. The very same who believe those workers in the role of taxpayers should maintain them in the style to which they are accustomed as the aristocracy of capitalism, come hell or high water. Therefore, the discussion of systemic change, which will continue on the program this week, is especially timely. The crises we face provide an opportunity to reevaluate human society, to ask what we want, what we need, and how to get there from here, especially when the leaders of society and its dominant voices are unwilling or unable to consider anything outside of a relatively narrow range of options that are at best Sisyphean reforms, always eventually rolling downhill. People are suffering now, and the economic predictions indicate it will get worse. What is the point of it? So that bankers can party? Most of the people who will suffer were not at the party in the first place. There is nothing worse than pointless suffering, useless sacrifice. If one must suffer, let it at least be for a new world to rise.
I was managing my assets late one night when my eyes beheld a dreadful sight. The economy began to destabilize, and suddenly, to my surprise,
the market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
A monster crash.
No one could borrow cash.
The market crashed.
It collapsed in a flash.
The market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
From the corner office and executive suite to the trading floor and throughout Wall Street, everybody came from their humble abodes to salvage what they could while the system implodes.
The market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
A monster crash.
No one could borrow cash.
The market crashed.
It collapsed in a flash.
The market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
Wall Street was having fun. The party had just begun. The guests included Greenspan, Bernanke, and Paul Sun.
The scene was rocking, or were digging the sounds of the bailout bills that were making the rounds. From Congress, relief was about to arrive. $700 billion to keep us alive.
We got some cash.
We got some monster cash.
Some monster cash.
It was a Wall Street smash.
We got some cash.
It arrived in a flash.
We got some cash.
We got some monster cash.
Out of the coffin, a voice did ring. Someone was troubled by this whole thing. We opened the lid to see who was there. He said, whatever happened to laissez-faire?
It's turned to mash.
It's turned to monster mash.
Out with the trash.
There was a strong backlash.
It's turned to mash.
Wall Street was much too rash.
It's turned to mash.
It's turned to monster mash.
Now everything is cool, it has gone as planned, and the bailout bill is the law of the land. In a few more years, we'll forget, and then unregulated markets will be back again.
Then we can mash.
And we can lend out cash.
The monster mash.
Subprimes will be a smash.
Then we can mash.
We'll get rich in a flash.
Then we can mash.
We'll lend out lots of cash.
Wamu, Freddie Mac, Wamu, AIG, Wamu, Wamu, Fannie Mae, Wamu, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns.
Monster Crash by the Telefonics. Before I get to more speakers from the Confronting the Triple Crisis conference, I'm going to play you an interview from one of my favorite shows, The Monitor, heard Sundays on KPFT Radio in Houston. People from across the political spectrum have concluded that we have a variety of systemic problems. Even relatively mainstream people are deeply dissatisfied with the pervasive corruption and are seeking alternatives. Some, like the person we'll hear from next, has developed her critique based on her proximity to the centers of power and finance. Here's host Mark Babawi, who will introduce his guest.
Joining us now live is our guest for tonight, and that is Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
It's good to have you on. You're one of those people that I've been meaning to get on for a while, and I'm glad to have finally gotten around to it. Unfortunately pushed by a very bad economy to get somebody on to talk about what's going on with the economy. Before we jump into the interview, let me just tell people a little bit more about you. Currently, you are the president of Solari, that website for people to take a look at, and there's a lot of very useful stuff on there, by the way, is solari.com, S-O-L-A-R-I.com. Before that, you worked with Hamilton Securities. Before that, and I think perhaps most famously for the majority of my listeners, you were in the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development in D.C. That was from 89 to 90. And for a big chunk of time before that, you spent a lot of time with various financial institutions, Goldman Sachs, Santa Fe National Bank, and you've done obviously more than your fair share at universities with BAs and MBAs and so on. So before we get into talking about what's happening today with the economy, I just want to give people a little bit of a flavor of what you experienced in the federal government and what it is you found at HUD. So give us a thumbnail sketch of that story, if you could.
Well, what I found was that government investments and activities were being designed to generate profits for corporations in a way that centralized the economy as opposed to what I would call optimize the total economic return of the economy or of a place. So if you look at, in 1997, I did an analysis for a group of pension fund leaders on all government investment going into the Philadelphia area. And what we were able to demonstrate is that it had a negative return on investment. So think of a body, and each time you pump it up with steroids, the body gets weaker. And so government investment in place, what I discovered when I worked at HUD, was government investment in places was helping to control places, but it wasn't building a strong economy. It wasn't building any kind of real resistance, and it was paying people a great deal of money to do things which I would describe as making them stupider. So in a nutshell, we have a negative return on investment on our government investment in places.
And of course, the other thing that you found, and certainly wasn't restricted to HUD, was that a lot of money just sort of disappeared.
Right. You had two flows. So you had overt flows of contracts, of purchases, of program subsidies, and credit, and then you had covert flows. And there was significant amounts disappearing on the covert side. And when I first worked as Assistant Secretary of Housing, I kept bumping into them. I finally had to leave because I kept getting orders to do things that were illegal, and I wouldn't do it. But then after I left and started my own company, Hamilton Securities Group, eventually got hired back on competitive bid to help the FHA as the financial advisor. And what we found is that every time you tried to run HUD clean, you ran into this huge demand for, side deals. It took me many years to really understand what was going on. But to give you an example, in 1999, $59 billion was missing from HUD. The agency never produced audited financial statements as required by law. And the resolution of that fact was that nothing was ever done, and the next year more was missing, but they refused to say how much.
And the Pentagon, of course, famously, I think it was September 10th, right before the attacks on the 11th, was the day that Rumsfeld said that there was he tried to put it comically, which was quite offensive, I thought, that he was saying, oh, somewhere in the region of, you know, $1.1 trillion was, like, disappeared.
Right.
And this is pretty rampant in federal bodies, it seems.
Yeah, there's 3.3 missing from the Pentagon, and when I say 3.3, that's what government documents document.
3.3 what?
3.3 trillion.
That's trillion with a T.
That's trillion with a T.
There's an awful lot of zeros.
Well, one of my beliefs is that one of the reasons that the Treasury and the Fed refused to say where the bailouts are going is because there was so much securities fraud. If HUD is missing $59 billion in 1 year, or the Pentagon's missing $2.3 trillion in 1 year, the only way that can happen is with securities fraud. And I believe the mortgage-backed securities and Treasury security mortgage fraud and the securities being issued off balance sheet are very significant. And that's part of what we're watching with the bailouts, is sort of cleaning up that situation.
Well, so you segued me into the next question perfectly to talk about the bailouts in a little bit more detail. We've been told with the bank bailouts already that a significant portion of the money has been spent, but we don't know where and we can't track how. It's a little bit less wishy-washy with the auto industry, and I suspect that's because some people actually understand what a car is, whereas very few people understand what a default credit swap might be. Do you think, when you say cleanup, do you think we're going to end up returning the balance sheet to zero and restarting the system as is, or are we going to actually clean it up?
Well, what you're watching is a financial coup d'etat.
Explain.
Well, there is no government. A group of defense contractors and large banks got together and stole trillions of dollars. That's real money. And in the process, they did it in a way that they could end up controlling the government on a day-to-day basis. For example, you'll walk into government agencies now where literally there are no government officials who understand how the operations work. They're all completely delegated to large banks and defense contractors. And moreover, the government is now, with this amount of money stripped out, is completely financially dependent on its creditors. So you don't have financial sovereignty and you don't have information sovereignty. In other words, if large banks and large defense contractors are running all the information systems in my company, then I have no ability to decide anything secret from them.
And you obviously, and in this case at least, you don't know what they're doing with the money.
Right.
The books are not open.
Right. So you basically have a group of parties who've been running government, you know, increasingly more, but certainly since the mid-90s, and they've been running it to serve their ends, whatever those are. They're clearly outside of the Constitution. And where this money's gone and what they're doing with it, we can't say. But what we can say is there is no government. That's why when you see calls for greater regulation and say let's give government more power, my question is, what government? There is no government. We've had a coup.
And what kind of power? Now, off air, I'm actually an auditor, so I understand a little bit about this stuff. And one of the things that's very common when you have a contract between two parties is something called the right to audit. There is no such right for the U.S. government and therefore for the U.S. public with all of these companies that are given all these billions of dollars. Is there anyone in the legislative body, is the president or anyone else, have you heard any of them talking about this or even discussing the possibility of open bookkeeping?
Well, in the summer of, I believe it was 2001, I went to a town hall meeting in my local county and asked a very fine Tennessee congressman about the $3.3 trillion missing. He was on the budget committee, and he was on the appropriation committee for defense. And I said to him, in front of all my neighbors, there's $3.3 trillion missing from the Pentagon. And he said, yes, I know. He was. I guess it was 2002. He was part of the group proposing the $48 billion increase in defense appropriations after 9/11. And he said, yes, I know. And I said, what have you done about it? And he said, there's. He looked at me shocked, and he said, nothing. There's nothing I can do. Now, I'm assuming what he meant by that was that it was not politically feasible or physically safe for him to try and do anything about it. For example, Obama has just appointed, during the time the money went missing at the Pentagon, the chief financial officer of the Pentagon was a gentleman named William J. Lynn, and the controller for the Air Force was a gentleman named Robert Hale. Obama has now appointed Mr. Lynn as the deputy secretary. Of the Pentagon. That's the number two position, and he's appointed Robert Hale the chief financial officer. So essentially, the people who engineered $3.3 trillion disappearing are now back in more senior positions at Pentagon.
This is certainly not change you can believe in. Have you gotten any less cynical or any more hopeful about the possibility of real change in the U.S. political system with regards to finances specifically?
Well, I'm very hopeful in this sense. If you go back over 500 years, because if you spend any time looking at sort of this system of overt and covert, and then the covert that's growing larger and larger like a cancer, what you realize, it's all part of a model that's 500 years old. It's called the central banking warfare model, and it's really the basis of the success of the English-speaking nations or the European nations. For 500 years, we've been roaming around the planet, either printing paper and using our military to get people to hold the paper and to benefit us in trade so that we get control of the natural resources, et cetera. And it's a non-sustainable model. And now we're coming with globalization. We're coming into the end game, which is we need to find an economic model which is more sustainable than simply a pincer movement that drains some to benefit a few. And I think really we're just coming into the end game of facing that. I used to have a wonderful pastor in Washington who would say, if we can face it, God can fix it. So we're coming into a place where we can face it, And part of what's happening is we've used our technology to create more and more powerful weapons and more powerful surveillance technology. And you put those technologies behind a culture which is fundamentally violent, as an economic model, and this is what you get. So I'm an optimist in the sense that I think facing it is, you know, for my entire lifetime, I've lived in a culture that is in a state of denial. And now we're coming out of a state of denial, and that's healthy.
Well, no, I agree with you, and I think I agree with the pastor about facing it. But to face something, you've got to know about it. Do you think a significant enough number of people know about this? It seems like the majority of people I run into, somewhere in the depths of their being, they know that there's something wrong. They know that the system isn't working. They know that this, you know, bubble and burst and crash you know, it's just there's something fundamentally at its core that isn't right. And I think a lot of people can just sense that, but I don't think they really understand it. What can people do to get a better grasp of all of this?
Well, I've found it's complex and it breaks out into different kinds of groups. But I find that if you take most really responsible people, they break down in a couple of categories. The first category is one who thinks it's hopeless, and so they don't want to go down the rabbit hole and look at what's really going on, because it'll be so draining and unpleasant and overwhelming that then they won't get anything positive done. So they kind of hide from it. The second is someone who, for some serendipity, has come on to an understanding that allows them to really see that it's not hopeless at all, and that there is a sort of a way out of the darkness. And then they dig in and start to really learn a lot. So
you're in that second group, clearly.
Well, you know, I got into the second group against my will.
Right. Well, so the serendipitous event for you was your experience at HUD, I presume.
No, what happened was, well, my company was serving as the financial advisor to HUD, but we were making software tools called Community Wizard, which would allow the user to just collect up all the databases of government money and spending and taxes in their place and aggregate and create sources and uses of government resources in their place.
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever seen the movie Enemy of the State?
I have, yes.
Okay, well, I played Will Smith in real life because they seized our offices.
You were running around on a rooftop with no clothes on? I don't know. I'm kidding. Okay.
Actually, something close to that happened. But anyway, so you know, but literally I went through years of physical harassment, surveillance, and smear campaigns, and you know, Will Smith got it done much faster than I did.
Sure.
And but essentially, I got thrown overboard of the Titanic, so I had no choice but to build arcs.
Yeah.
And it was in that process that I decided that I really had to understand the covert side, and dug in and started researching. But because of my situation, I had access to a lot of the information and the network of people who could provide me with the information on the covert. So the hard part for me was, how do you get all the information on the covert and do it in a way which is pleasant and entertaining?
Well, you've done that, and you know, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. But I wanted to ask you one quick question, and I'll have to get you back on for a more extended discussion about not only Solari and what Solari does, but what you think everyday people can do. Very practical
things. Well,
that's
right. That's what's the important thing, is that people act in the short term in a way that advantages themselves, but that turns around the whole situation.
Yeah, so let's spend a couple of minutes on that if you have the time.
Sure.
Just to say, just practical things. You know, an everyday person, for example, let's take me. You have you work at a job, you have a 401k.
Right.
The market starts to slide, your 401k starts to shrink, you start to wonder whether it's worth the penalty, take the money out. Is it even worth having a 401k if you're just propping up this two-dimensional house of cards that is, you know, constantly having to get bailouts to survive, and the system is not sustainable? And as you said, the end game is built on a political and economic model that is basically founded in violence and dispossession. What does an everyday average person do with their money?
Well, the first thing you try and do is you try and put as many degrees of separation between you and any person or institution that you know is doing evil. So one of the things I assume is in the court of popular opinion, you're guilty until proven innocent. So you should assume that a bank is dirty unless you know otherwise. It's different, you know. It's an opposite standard than would reign in a court of law.
Right.
And what you're just trying to do, and you want to do it really incrementally, is any time that you can put separation. So an obvious one, if you can bank at a high quality local bank or credit union or savings bank that you really know to be sensitive to the local community and to be responsibly run, you have to look at who governs, et cetera. And you get your money out of any of the institutions that are running the government this way or getting bailouts, and get into a good local bank or credit union. That's kind of step number one, because you want to make sure you're giving not just your money but your data to people who are honest and trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so number one is your bank. Second is your purchases. Where do you spend money? As much as you can, spend money with either people or institutions that are or companies that are honest and decent, et cetera, et cetera. You know, do that. Then the third, of course, is your investments. Now, a lot of people, unless you leave your place of employment, can't necessarily pull money out of their 401k. So there's a lot of different fact patterns, but the more you can get out of large corporations and get out of large banks and start investing in things that you really know, that activities or people that you know to be ethical and honest and effective. Because remember, we need your money to be going up in value, not down. So don't do this just on the basis of ethics. Do it on the basis of trying to only invest in that, which is excellent. Then the fourth thing is a big category that a lot of people don't understand, donations.
Well, you're saying it at the right time. I didn't tell you before I got you on the air, but we're in the middle of our pledge drive right now.
Perfect. Well, you know, cancel all your subscriptions to corporate media and stop watching corporate media and start giving your, you know, either subscription dollar or philanthropic dollar to institutions that are providing you with real information. So donations are incredibly important, and I generally... You know, I see so many families who are giving their donations essentially back to the organizations that are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So, because a lot of these endowments, the big endowments are, you know, they're not what they appear to most people to be. They're really investment syndicates who are engaged in racketeering globally. So donations are very important. And then I would say, as well, your attention. So I go back to media attention. TV stations get tremendous money from advertisers because we pay attention to what they say. So, you know, not giving your attention to people who are not giving us the truth, but giving your attention to people who are giving us the truth is unbelievably important. So in every aspect, and what you'll find is if you walk around a community and you look at the endowment at the church and the university, and you look at everybody's 401k and IRAs, and you look at the pension funds and the reserves at the school, and, you know, you just walk around every community in America and collect up all the money. We're all shipping our money off to Wall Street, and it's not coming back, and it's not being used in ethical ways. There's a wonderful article by Janine Roth, who lost all of her money in Madoff. In the middle of it, she says, you know, why was I putting my money into something that was a black box that was going to, you know, probably going to things that I didn't either understand or believe in?
Right. Well, good advice, Catherine.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm appalled at the money we put into corporate media and then don't fund the media that's telling us the truth.
Go to her website, solari.com, S-O-L-A-R-I.com. There's a lot of good advice on there. There's some very interesting articles. There's a blog section. Catherine's resume on there. I didn't read all of it, obviously. It's detailed and it's distinguished. And Catherine, I really appreciate your time tonight, and I'll have you back on very soon.
I'd love to do it. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too. All right. That was Catherine Austin Fitz.
And that was Mark Babawi, host of The Monitor on KPFT Houston. Find out more about The Monitor at themonitor.wordpress.com. For the past month, I've been playing you presentations from a conference held in late 2007, put on by the International Forum on Globalization, and titled Confronting the Triple Crises. It's examined a variety of angles relating to the problem of the unsustainable society. The economics of endless growth and consumption based on cheap fossil energy has no future on a planet whose finite resources are rapidly depleting. We'll pick up where we left off last week on the topic of systemic change.
First, I want to introduce Dr. Thomas Prinsen. He explores issues of social and ecological sustainability at the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Michigan. He's the author of The Logic of Sufficiency and lead editor of Confronting Consumption, two great works. He was an Aldo Leopold Fellowship, Leadership Fellow, and before that, a Pew Faculty Fellow for International Affairs. Please welcome Dr. Thomas Prinsen.
Thank you, Megan. I want to make just one point, okay? And that is that principles matter. Okay? Social organizing principles matter. They matter to maintain the status quo, and they matter to affect fundamental change. Okay? The current principles that sustain our current order, namely endless growth, efficiency, consumer sovereignty with its insatiability component, are not up to the task of confronting the triple crisis. So we need new principles, principles that are consonant with the very nature of the crisis. Consider these three scenarios. First, the slide. Good, there it is. Okay. Now, if you've been up to Maine, you might have seen a situation like this. But what's happening here is this lobster catcher had worked very hard, over months possibly, under very dangerous conditions, to get that trap out in the water, leave it there for a few days, and pull it back up, along with about maybe 400, 500, or 600 other traps. And he got that trap. Oh, and I should also explain that if it was a typical day, it would be blowing wind, cloudy, and maybe snowing. Okay, this is in the middle of winter when they fish, so it's dangerous. So he goes to all that work and all that danger, pulls up the trap, opens it up and pulls out a lobster and throws the lobster back. Okay. We can assume for the moment that this is a perfectly healthy lobster. That if you're like me, you enjoy eating lobsters. You'd like to have that lobster on your dinner plate with some melted butter and a bib, and you like to have it. But he's throwing it back. This is bizarre behavior for a fisherman. Okay? And it wasn't always like this. Of course, he's doing it for some good reasons. It might have been too small or too large, or it might have been an egg-bearing female. But not so long ago, just in the 20th century, the pattern was if it was too small, you just chop it up and feed it to your chickens. Or if it was too large, you take it down to the local restaurant and sell it at a premium price. Or if it had eggs on its underside, you just scrape them off and keep it. But things changed over a period of years and decades, and those practices have largely disappeared. And it's in part because of what individuals like this did, but it's largely due to what collectivities of fishermen and fishing officials have done over the years in Maine. Okay? That is, they have decided that it makes sense not to take every last lobster. It makes sense to restrain their harvest because in the long run, they all do better. Okay? And on this particular island, they also decided that if they stop fishing for 6 months a year, they do better. The lobsters do better, and the fisher folk do better. And they also figured out that if they only put out a limited number of traps, they wouldn't risk over harvesting. So they build in sort of a buffer to that harvesting. Okay. So restraint, respite, some downtime in the season. Buffer, I see these as operational principles under the larger principle of sufficiency, doing well, and let me emphasize, doing well, this is a very healthy fishery, doing well by doing less than the most possible. Second scenario, put that down. Imagine you were given charge of, let's say, a dozen children, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 13-year-olds, okay, for an afternoon. Now, some of you already know what's coming here, right? You've had this situation. Let's imagine you take them down to a park, and unlike a lot of adults these days, you don't tell them exactly what they're supposed to do, but you say, just go out and play. You know, the park is yours. Do whatever you want to do. And we'll assume for the moment that it's perfectly safe. Okay. Now, what will those children do? They're basically good children, okay? The first thing they'll do is they'll start exploring. They'll just look around the trees and the rocks and so forth. You know. And at some point, one of them will say, hey, let's play hide and seek. Or let's play tag. Or let's play kickball. And they say, yeah, that's a great idea. You know, first base will be that tree, and second base will be that rock, and the little kids will line up first, and let's get going. And then somebody else says, no, actually, that rock ought to be first base, and the tree ought to be second. And the big kids should go first, because they always do go first. And they start arguing and arguing. Sound familiar? Yeah. Studies have shown the children will spend up to 40% of their time arguing about the rules when they're playing. And good observation has shown that many adults get very frustrated with this. Why don't you stop arguing and just play? And what those adults don't realize is that they are playing. Playing is setting the rules. And when they start arguing about which rules are the right rules, that's not fair, you can't do that. Or we didn't do it that way before. Or if you have the base way out there, it takes too much time, and so on. Yeah. When they start arguing about that, they are, in a sense, creating principles, overarching norms about what those rules are going to be. The point here is that it is very human to set rules and to establish principles of social organization. We are social creatures. We cannot help but do that. Okay. Third scenario. This is a different playground, different actors, different rules. But it seems it's one where people have a lot of fun. It's called international trade. Okay. For a long time, what this meant was that a country would build up its power by erecting trade barriers, protecting its domestic industry, exporting selectively to particular trading partners, and keeping out others' goods from their country, protecting their domestic industry. That was the game. And apparently it worked on its own terms for quite a while, at least for those who won the game, until it all came crashing down in the Great Depression and World War II. And towards the end of World War II, some policymakers, economists, and others got together in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, and they said, basically, we can't let this happen again. We've got to do something different. We have to write different rules. And they figured out very quickly that it wasn't enough to just write the rules. But they had to establish the principles that was overarching those rules. And they landed on three principles. Now, as I go through these, notice how these principles relate to the very nature of the crisis that they faced at that time. Okay? The first was liberalization. Bring down those trade barriers. That was a major cause of the Great Depression. The next is non-discrimination. If you're going to trade with one country, you trade with everybody. No special deals. Another major cause. And if there's going to be exceptions to these first two, then we'll do it through multilateral agreements. Multilateralism was the third principle. Okay. Those three principles basically have governed the global trade regime for a good half century to this day. and on its own terms has been very effective. And the reason is because those principles fit the nature of the crisis that they faced back then. We have a different crisis now. We need new principles. So the question that arises then in my mind is, what are the principles that we need? What are the principles that govern the current economic order? And are they up to the task? As I see it, we have an economic system, a system of material and energy flow that is supremely well organized. Now, notice when I say organized, it immediately implies principles. Okay? We have an economy supremely well organized to extract raw materials rapidly and thoroughly, hence the efficiency principle, to convert those materials to products that people will buy. And notice that's different than what people need. 1.2 billion people need fresh water and can't buy it. And this principle, underlying principle here is consumer sovereignty or consumer demand. And this material system is supremely well organized to create markets everywhere and open up new markets, hence the growth principle, and to dispose of the waste in the least costly, least visible manner possible. Efficiency again, and the out of sight, out of mind principle. And it's well organized to do all of this more and more, faster and faster, making good time, and cheaper and cheaper. Right? Again, growth, efficiency, cheaper is better principles. Okay? Seems to me these are the very principles that got us into the current crisis. And it defies all logic to say that we can use the same principles to get us out of this crisis, to do virtually just the opposite of what has occurred over the past century or two, however you want to count. And yet we keep hearing claims assertions of one sort or another. We've got to grow our economy, but with green products. We've got to pollute. I always do pollute, but we do it more efficiently. And after all, consumers are buying it all, so that's what they want. Okay? I think we need a new logic, and we need some new principles. So the question then is, where do we get those principles? Do we pull them out of thin air? Well, the examples I gave you and just all the others that I know, that's not how it happens. Those principles emerge from action and from deliberation. Okay? They are constructed. They're deliberately constructed. Think again of the architects of the trade regime. They pick those principles out because they fit the need of the time. But they are constructed in the same way that, as Megan mentioned, a farmer has been constructed in such pejorative terms over the recent decades and so on. They are just constructed. There's nothing natural or inevitable. They haven't been around forever. Growth, efficiency, consumer sovereignty, and so on, insatiability, and so forth. And because they've been constructed, we can reconstruct them, we can deconstruct them, we can destroy them and put up new ones. As I mentioned, the favorite place to get such principles is the existing order. The predominant way is, of course we have to grow the economy, of course we have to be more efficient. Of course, consumers decide everything. The economy is geared for the consumer. But I think I hope I've established that this is illogical. So a third possibility for where we get those principles, seems to me, is existing practice. I'm going to slide up again. That if we can find examples, not that one though,